Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'm talking to one of the two authors of Neither Liberal or Conservative, Ideological Innocence in the American Public, published by University of Chicago Press in 2017. I have the real pleasure to have Nathan Calmo on the phone today. Nathan, how are you doing today?
Doing real well. How are you, Heath?
I'm doing well. Before we get to talk about your very timely book, maybe you can briefly introduce yourself and also your co-author, Donald Kinder.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me. I'm assistant professor of political communication in the Manship School of Mass Communication and the Department of Political Science at Louisiana State University. And my co-author, Don Kinder, is the Philip E. Converse Collegiate Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Michigan.
Yeah, wonderful. And Philip Converse features prominently in this book. And let's begin our conversation right there. You start the book by describing the essay written by Philip Converse in 1964. This essay caused, as you write about, quite a commotion. I wonder if you just sort of summarize the essay for us and what the sort of key claim of the essay was and why it received such attention at the time.
Sure. There's sort of bigger questions of democracy about figuring out how the public makes sense of politics and in particular whether they have the sophistication to understand and connect political ideas that seems really necessary for stronger versions of democracy. And Converse is noting in this essay that politicians, journalists, academics often assumed that the public more or less looked like political elites in the way that they approached politics. And he turned to some novel survey data at the time to really examine that question about whether the public is able to make the kinds of connections that you see among political elites. And in particular, he comes to a rather pessimistic conclusion. He first looks at how people talk about politics when they're asked to talk about parties and candidates and elections, and finds that on their own they don't make much use of ideological concepts, these sort of high-order abstract principles to describe why they like or dislike parties and candidates. Next, he looks at whether they have an understanding when asked to explain what the terms liberal or conservative mean and how they align with the two parties, that people struggle to do that as well. He broadened this out and said, well, maybe people don't naturally talk about these abstractions and maybe don't understand them or can't articulate them at least, but maybe they at least have a kind of a structure to their political views, and in particular their issue attitudes, that they cohere, that knowing how where somebody stands on one issue tells you quite a bit about where they stand on another issue, say defense spending versus the size and scope of government in terms of the social safety net, that kind of thing. And he finds that there's very little what he calls constraint, or this structure of how one issue can view can predict the others. And then finally, he says, well, maybe there's not this sort of set liberal conservative idea that we have of constraint in these issue opinions. People might still have a structure in mind that's more idiosyncratic. So let's look at the stability of those views over time. If there's a central structure, even an idiosyncratic structure in people's minds about how they think about politics, that should provide a grounding in their views over the course of a handful of years. And he looks at panel data, of survey data, to find that, in fact, there's a very high level of instability in people's issue preferences over time on the same issues, on the same questions, and that this suggests that really they don't have a kind of structure to their attitudes at all. And so overall, it's a very pessimistic conclusion that there's maybe a narrow strata of people who are more engaged in politics, who are more knowledgeable about politics, who do show some evidence of this, but we're talking about maybe one out of every five people in the public and not the majority, to be sure.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about the pushback and the controversy and this idea of ideological innocence, being innocent of the deeply held ideological beliefs that we might believe the public actually holds. You try to reconcile some of the debate, and so maybe you could first talk a little bit about the pushback on this and how that led you to write the book.
This is longstanding debates, and some of the pushback came very quickly after Converse published this essay that got a ton of attention. Some of the critiques were methodological, saying that I won't get into the weeds here, but basically saying that when you ask questions, there's some inherent error in the responses that people are making, and that can cause some trouble. But subsequent analysis seemed to knock down some of those concerns. Another aspect was that Converse's data were coming from the 1950s, which some people saw as a particularly quiet period of relatively unpolarized parties, and before all of the tumult of the civil rights movement and Vietnam protests and all of that really broke out, the Great Society program in the mid to late 1960s. And so some scholars thought that maybe this non-ideological character, this ideological innocence in the public, was just an artifact of the time and place that Converse was looking at. And in fact, when you looked at responses after the 1970s, you saw the same kinds of patterns. And so it didn't seem to be a function of the nature of the times. And Converse made pretty bold claims about his findings, not just applying to the U.S. in the 1950s, but more broadly than that, across centuries, across nations even. Some of his later work looks at the French case about similar findings in France, and basically finding even in a public that's reputed to be especially ideological, they don't look any more ideological than the U.S. So across time and across places. One of the things that really motivated our approach in this book is that despite these pretty robust findings and that initial sort of dust-up that was caused by Converse's essay, starting in 1972, you have this new item appearing on the American National Election Study survey that asks people to place themselves as liberals or conservatives or moderates if they had thought about it at all. And a scholarly literature grew up around this finding that you have lots of people who seem to describe themselves as liberals or conservatives, and that there seem to be relationships between those descriptions and vote choice, issue preferences, and other sorts of political attitudes and behaviors. And that seems to run directly counter to what Converse was concluding in his essay. But it turns out that much of that research genre on ideological identification really didn't take up Converse's conclusion seriously, and so you have this disconnect, this conflict of no ideology in the public on one hand, and ideology almost as a key to understanding public opinion, but lines that really didn't speak to each other. So our book is about integrating those perspectives and seeing whether there really is a conflict, and seeing whether the public still lacks ideological sophistication 50 years later, despite the huge changes in politics in terms of party polarization, changes in society in terms of education and enfranchisement, and the media and information environment that's so different today from 50 years ago.
Yeah. So what is your argument about the formation of ideology? Why do some Americans claim to be ideologues, while others not so?
Well, one of the first things that we found when we dove into this is that about half of the public doesn't identify on the ideological spectrum. They either say that they don't know or that they haven't thought much about it. That's about a quarter of folks. And another quarter say that they're moderate, that they fall in the middle. But if we look at what is the sort of the sophistication and sort of the substance of people who are claiming moderation, our conclusion about that is that the moderate is kind of a default category for people who don't have a particularly sophisticated way of seeing politics. And so the key distinction between people who call themselves liberals or conservatives and people who claim not to have thought about it at all or claim moderation is political sophistication, this idea that the public is deeply or broadly stratified in levels of political knowledge, that you have politics is for some people who find it interesting and find it comprehensible, and for many people there are other things that they can that they prefer to follow. And that difference is key in figuring out who is likely to identify on the ideological scale and who says, that's really not for me. And beyond that, then, even among those who do identify, we find that political sophistication, this level of engagement in politics, is the key factor, not just for who identifies, but also whether ideology has any potency in predicting how people think about the political world.
Now, ideology, we're told, is an important factor in our current debate about polarization. What did you find about whether the country is in fact becoming more ideologically polarized? And if it is, how much more polarized than in the past?
Yeah, so over time, the big picture is that the public is not really polarizing that much. We see over several decades a small uptick in the number of people who are placing themselves on the scale, but it's relatively small. And we see a little bit greater likelihood that people will take a substantive position to put themselves on the liberal side or on the conservative side, more so than several decades ago. But again, that's a small change and not a large one. And I should note that unlike party identification, which is sort of a running comparison throughout our book, that the distribution of responses on the ideological scale tends to stack up right in the middle of that scale. So if you're going to put yourself on the liberal side, you're going to call yourself slightly liberal. If you're going to put yourself on the conservative side, slightly conservative. Whereas you see people at the ends of the scale on partisanship really claim a strong identification to those. In terms of the big picture, so you do see those small upticks in identification and a little bit of movement to the polls, but not much. You don't see sort of the mirror image of polarization on ideology the way that you do in terms of partisanship. So in other words, Democrats these days are more likely to take liberal issue positions, but it's not the case that liberals are more likely to take liberal issue positions than they were decades ago. So we don't see an increase in that way that mirrors the partisan polarization. We don't see more hostility among liberals towards conservatives and among conservatives towards liberals the way that we do with partisans expressing more affective hostility towards out partisans. We do see a little bit of an increase in the fusion of partisanship, of party identity with ideological identification, but that still shouldn't be overstated. About 40% of people now share the ideological identification that you would think goes with their party identification. So about 40% of the public is either Democrat and liberal or Republican and conservative. So we still don't have a majority of folks who are identifying in that way. We're far away from that kind of a fusion.
So would it be right to say that the country is ideologically innocent but guilty of partisanship? Is that part of what you're saying?
We haven't. I think that's the conviction that we have rendered in the book. The parallel throughout of partisanship shows that in comparison, ideology is always a weak factor in comparison to partisanship in terms of the amount of identification, in terms of the power of that identification to tell us anything about political behavior. And whereas ideology only seems to have much influence on people who are politically sophisticated, we see a wide-ranging influence of partisanship, high potency, even among people who are low in political knowledge with their partisanship, especially in making choices about who to vote for. It's easy for people to make those kinds of connections. So in the absence of these abstract ideological principles, people are primarily guided by their party identifications in almost a tribal way, in an identification that's rooted very much in broader social identities. And beyond partisanship, people are reasoning about politics on the basis of ethnocentrism and using their attitudes about prominent social groups to figure out where they stand, and not these broad abstracted political principles that we associate with ideology.
Now, how does this discussion of ideology matter to things, other things that we care about, like voting? You alluded to it just a little bit right there, but maybe you could talk a little more specifically about these relationships.
One of the reasons why ideology is probably less potent than partisanship in voting is that it's really easy to find, you know, the D or the R next to a candidate's name on the ballot. We contest elections and have a rather cacophonous experience every 2 years for congressional and every 4 years for presidential elections, in which the party is being emphasized over and over again. Sometimes there's ideological ideas that come up in that rhetoric, but they're primarily contested on the basis of party. Although even when we have especially ideological campaigns, that we often don't see much shift in people's ideological response to those campaigns in terms of their identification. The big picture is that people are able to make their electoral choices on the basis of partisanship, whether or not they have much information about politics, whereas ideological identification is really only a useful way of moving through the electoral politics if you have the knowledge to make the connections, that sort of the broader political structure in your mind that can see what relates to what. And so that aspect makes the use of ideology much more conditional in its influence on voting than partisanship. One of the things that we see even before we take political knowledge into account is that partisanship is dwarfing the impact of ideology in this way. And that difference is especially acute if you take into account the differences in distribution. Like I said, you only have 2 or 3% of people in the most extreme categories of ideology. You've got 30, 40% of people who are showing up in the sort of the polar categories of partisanship, and that means that you have a lot, when you estimate the influence of this factor from one end of the scale to the other, you have a lot more people that have that strongest difference going on in their voting behavior when you're looking at partisanship compared to ideology. So that amplifies that difference, especially when you think about half the public either not putting themselves on the ideological scale at all, or choosing the midpoint.
Yeah, Nathan's really interesting book with Don Kinder is called, again, Neither Liberal or Conservative, Ideological Innocence in the American Public, published by the University of Chicago Press this year. Nathan, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.